COVID-19 has upset the balance of the world, and while some countries are starting to settle into a new normal, South Africa is unfortunately not there yet. You are listening to the Everything You Need to Know About COVID-19 and Vaccines podcast series brought to you by Discovery Health. This series is aimed at helping you understand the facts around COVID-19 and vaccines in South Africa. Now, for today, we are talking about mandatory vaccine policies with Dr. Ryan Noach, who is CEO of Discovery Health, together with Safura Abdul Karim, who is a public health lawyer. I am your host, Mudiwa Gabaza, writer for The Business Day and Financial Mail, and this is a conversation that is not to be missed. Now, on the 2nd of September 2021, Group CEO of Discovery, Adrian Gore, announced that the company intends to implement a mandatory vaccine policy effective from the 1st of January 2022. And that actually got a lot of people up in arms on one hand, but at the same time, it had arousing support on the other. Just starting off with you, Doctor, you know, where does mandatory vaccination actually fit into the broader approach of keeping employees safe in the workplace? And, you know, maybe you could just talk to us about the type of decision making that actually went into something like this. I'm sure it wasn't easy.
Thanks, Mudiwa. Great to be with you again. And the rules of engagement are that you may not call me doctor. You have to call me Ryan. Mudiwa, this is part of a spectrum of decisions that we've taken, much like many other employers, over time, over the past 20 months. You know, a holistic view of how we best protect our employees. We've been particularly circumspect and worked very hard to protect our employees. And I should say up front, there have been 22 Discovery Group employees in South Africa that have unfortunately succumbed and died from COVID-19. That's 22 more than we wanted. And it's tragic. They leave a huge gap in their families' lives, in our teams, you know, for our colleagues and for our system. And we really want to prevent a further death. And this is actually within the context of preventing death that we consider this mandatory vaccination. Of course, we've implemented mask policies. We've sent about 8,500 people to work from home. We've had social distancing for those that remain in the office. We've had markedly improved and increased hygiene and disinfection procedures in our offices. We've put disinfectant fans to extract bacteria out of our lifts. We've put, facial ID and temperature recognition systems into all of our offices. We've invested extensively and changed policy. And the mandatory vaccination program is just part of that spectrum of initiatives. We think it's an important and necessary initiative to make sure that the majority of our staff who are vaccinated and come to the office are not placed at risk by a small number of unvaccinated individuals still coming to the office. And just the last comment on this is to say, we are a company that has a strong culture. We look forward to that sense of belonging and that connectedness of being back in the office. In order to get back to the office safely, which we hope to do early next year, we think making sure everybody is fully vaccinated is a critical component of that.
Safura, maybe I can just bring you in, you know, very quickly to get some initial thoughts, because this was one of those announcements that really, I think it was a bit of a surprise, you know, for the market. And I know that it did send shockwaves across corporate South Africa, government, etc. So from your point of view, because I know that we're going to talk to you about, you know, constitutionality and all of these, big legal terms later on, but just your initial thoughts around that decision when it first came out.
So I think from, you know, as lawyers, we are always prepared for whatever might eventuate. And so I had been working on this issue with other lawyers since probably December, January. And so this was not something that people, you know, were not thinking about. I think people were being very preemptive. What the challenge remains is that because we do have vaccine scarcity, not just in South Africa, but in the region. And so there is this immense tension between do we have enough vaccines to allow for a mandate and the need to kind of incentivize people to be vaccinated. What I will also acknowledge is that as much as we've been working on this and thinking about this as lawyers, vaccine mandates are not a silver bullet to reaching population level immunity or high coverage of a population. They're part of a suite of interventions, and how they look is very dependent on context. It's very dependent on what type of group you're trying to target and why they're not getting vaccinated. So we can't think that this is a band-aid to solve vaccine hesitancy or even low vaccination uptake. This is just one in a suite of measures that South Africans need to be thinking about.
No, thank you so much for that, Sofura. And I think, you know, to that point, it makes perfect sense that it's not a silver bullet. Rather, it's one sort of tool in the basket of tools that should be used by people to try and combat.
There's actually a very interesting model that relates directly to the theory that you're talking about now. It's called the Swiss cheese approach to protection against biological disease. Yeah. If you think of Swiss cheese, that Emmentaler type cheese, which I love, but isn't that healthy, it's got those holes in it. And if you layer many slices of those Swiss cheese slivers next to each other, those holes never line up. And actually, if you want to be protected against this biological disease, COVID-19, you need that Swiss cheese approach. No single slice is impenetrable because each slice has got a hole. Layer multiple slices alongside each other, and those holes never line up. And that Swiss cheese model, which is not our model, it's a well-described epidemiological model of mitigating biological risk. That Swiss cheese model is critical for any employer, any government, or any environment. You need to adopt multiple measures. Vaccines are not infallible, but they do provide one of those very reliable slices of the cheese within that Swiss cheese approach.
You know, on the back of, you know, the Swiss cheese approach that you've just given to us, and also, you know, the comment from Sofura about the fact that, you know, this is, you know, one of the tools. Maybe you can talk to us about how Discovery is actually planning to implement this plan, right? Will this policy be applied to clients, new employees and suppliers? What measures have actually been put in place, or will these be developed as a later stage? You know, because I think one of the things we're appreciating from what Sofura said is the fact that people have been thinking about this for a really long time. It's just that we're talking about it now, all these months down the line. So how are you guys approaching it? How are you guys thinking of actually implementing? Because the execution, to your point about
fortunate in that regard, as Sofura says, because we've seen many other countries across the world, particularly quite bold statements from the French president, Emmanuel Macron, and from the US president, Joe Biden, who have taken quite bold mandatory vaccination stances. This has kind of paved the way for us. So although we were the first large company in South Africa to announce it, we're certainly not alone across the globe. And it's been very helpful. The implementation is important. I mean, in our view, success would be that the mandate is meaningless and that everybody voluntarily gets vaccinated anyway. And by the time our deadline of 1 January comes along, that mandate is unimportant because everybody's vaccinated. That would be success. The implementation needs to be really, I think, underpinned by mutual respect. And in thinking about how we approach this, we took advice from multiple different sources, legal sources, ethical leadership, and experts and others. And, you know, Edwin Cameron, the retired constitutional court judge, who's one of the people that we spoke to, not only about the constitutional views, but more about his moral and social and ethical guidance around this, described to us this mutual respect that has to underpin everything we do. We have to accept that there are diverse views, that people have opinions. We have to be open to those diverse views. We have to meaningfully engage with them and understand everybody's positions. And then do our very best to try and find a means to reasonably accommodate those views. If somebody has a legitimate, rational, substantiated objection to vaccination, for example, they have a medical condition that they live with, which means vaccination is risky for them. There are not many of those, but they do exist. Or, for example, they have a religious objection which is substantiated by their own personal religious leader who's prepared to stand up and take a position that in their religion, vaccination is not acceptable. Those are positions we have to be empathic to for our staff. You know, believing the myths that abound and coming up with theories of toxins or microchips or Bluetooth activity emanating from vaccines, those are not rational and legitimate reasons for not being vaccinated in our view. But nonetheless, the implementation must be characterized by this meaningful engagement, one-on-one conversations with every single person who has a concern, education and information, sharing of data, and dealing with realistic fears and anxieties. And ultimately, for those that have, as I said earlier, legitimate and rational objections, ensuring that we seek to try and accommodate them reasonably, if their job type, their skills, and our work environment allows that. And that's critical. This has required us developing toolkits and empowering leaders to have these conversations, ensuring that we're highly accessible to the people, making sure that we spend a lot of time on disseminating information and educating, and then obviously incentivizing people to voluntarily get vaccinated and ensure access throughout that process.
Now, with everything that you've just described, I'm interested in the practicality of it all, right? Because you've sort of outlined for us, you know, some of the legitimate concerns that some people may have against getting vaccinated. And in some cases, it's beyond their control, health reasons and, you know, religious reasons, like what you've just said. So from a practical point of view, what does that actually do? Because on the one hand, you do have the others that might just flat out say, I just don't want to get vaccinated. But in being empathetic to all of those different concerns, how do you protect the ones that have been vaccinated from the ones that haven't been vaccinated? Because around the world, we've seen different implementations. I heard of a US company that's added, you know, extra charges for medical insurance for unvaccinated employees. Whereas in Canada, I've heard of companies where, because they don't have mandates in place, they're sort of working their work schedules for how people come in and out of the office, depending on, you know, whether people are vaccinated or not. So maybe you can talk to us about how you guys are thinking about those issues, the ones that just don't want to get vaccinated, how it practically actually happens, and then how do you protect the ones that have been vaccinated?
Yeah, I think the starting point is first just to step back and characterize for you what the response has been, just to give, you know, a feel, a realistic feel to how many people are in this bucket. Actually, 90% plus of our people have responded warmly and openly to this mandate. It's been welcomed. The majority of the people are already vaccinated. There are many that are intending to get vaccinated shortly. And, you know, they appreciate the fact that we're protecting their well-being. And in the main, this has been well received. So when you describe how we approach this, Mdiwa, there's a risk that it feels like it's pervasive. Actually, it's not. It's important for you to know that these groups are on the margin. When we look at the people that are currently unvaccinated and are hesitant, they're in two large groups. One bucket is people who are hesitant. They're anxious, they're uncertain, they're seeking information, they're not opposed. They have no fundamental problem with being vaccinated, but they're frightened. Now, that is completely plausible, and I get it. I completely understand it. And our responsibility to that group is to educate, inform, reassure, and make sure that we can do it for them in a safe way. Right on the margin, there is a small group who I would classify as anti-vaxxers. They're completely opposed. And I think this is the group that you're asking how we would handle pragmatically. I didn't want to dive into the pragmatic answer without first characterizing for you that it's a very small group on the margin. But the approach is exactly as you say. You know, we have to look at their individual skills, what their job encompasses day to day, and see if we can accommodate that within our workplace. Is there an opportunity for them to move to a job that can be exclusively work from home? That's not ideal from our point of view. We believe that sustaining our culture at Discovery, which is a very special culture and makes us who we are, we believe it requires a sense of connectedness and some minimal time in the office. But if there are a small number of people with legitimate reasons, is there an opportunity to work, for them to work permanently from home? I don't know. We need on an individual basis to understand that person's circumstance, skills, and job. If they are going to come into the office unvaccinated, is regular testing feasible? It's not something that we would subsidize, but if somebody chooses to be unvaccinated, you know, maybe they needed to be tested every time they're going to come into the office on a weekly basis, if they're coming in once a week or twice a week. You know, can they wear a mask permanently and perhaps double mask with a K95 and then another kind of more affordable, cheaper mask and double mask and ensure that they're offering the right protection? Can we locate them in the office in a location that's not only brilliantly ventilated, but is completely separated from other people so that they don't pose the risk of contamination to other people? Again, this is right on the margin that we're talking about this, but these are the pragmatic answers that I think you were looking for, that we are seeing elsewhere in the world, and that we certainly will consider on an individual basis where there are legitimate rational reasons for not being able to be vaccinated.
Safura, I'm going to ask for your thoughts around this, because as Discovery and as Ryan is just outlining how they're doing it, you know, it's one thing to operate within the world of Discovery, but that happens within a national context. And one of the big questions that's being asked, you know, pertaining to the different groups that Ryan has sort of outlined, a lot of people supporting, some having concerns, but at the same time, the ones that are, you know, classified as quote unquote anti-vaxxers, etc. What does the Constitution say? Because outside of some of the conspiracies, the question is just saying legally, what grounds do the likes of Discovery have for actually implementing some of these mandates?
So I think we're looking at a very complex intersection of different legal issues, because we're looking at public health and kind of employer obligations under that, and the Occupational Health and Safety Act to maintain safe workspaces. We're looking at individual rights to freedom of religion, freedom of political belief and thought, and bodily integrity. So there's a whole lot of streams. The way I like to think about how you plot these different buckets of people, if I can put it that way, is to think across three different streams. The first is, how high risk is their job? You know, is there a real substantial need for them to be vaccinated, or are they a low risk person? So a high risk person would be somebody like a healthcare worker, a frontline worker, something like that, where they not only pose a risk to themselves by not being vaccinated, but to a large group of other people. The low risk would be somebody like what Ryan just described, somebody who is maybe a desk-based worker, who can work from home, doesn't need to interact with others. And obviously, the closer you are to the high risk side, the more there is a need for you to be vaccinated. The second thing, because that's not enough, is you need to think about the basis for their objection. And I think the highest is you cannot be vaccinated for health reasons, because that's a bit non-negotiable. Like, you either can't, you know, you can or you can't be vaccinated. And if it's for health reasons, that's a very legitimate basis to not be vaccinated. And so that group, again, should be exempt from a vaccine mandate. And then, you know, there may be sort of this middle group, which I think is the toughest to negotiate, because you're really dealing with competing rights, is the people who are objecting for religious reasons, because that's still considered quite a protected class in South African law. And then you sort of have on the other end people who don't really have a legitimate basis to be objecting and are just doing so because they hold maybe unsubstantiated beliefs. And then the last prong, and this is very specific to South African law and very specific to workplaces, is what is the employer's ability to reasonably accommodate this person's objection? So even if they are a low risk and they have sort of a icky reason, if you can very easily accommodate them and put in place measures that lower their risk to others and lower their risk to themselves, ensuring that you maintain a safe working environment, then it would be much harder to justify mandating a vaccine. Whereas if you're falling on the other end of the spectrum, it's very easy. And so I think that's the key as people people begin to think about whether or not they want to implement vaccine mandates, to think about that. And it's not just in the workplace. If you can think about, you know, you talked about New York, you've talked, you know, we can talk about Israel, where they've started implementing proof of vaccination as a requirement to enter restaurants or gyms. Those are very high risk spaces. So, and they're also luxury amenities, right? Like, you don't have to go to a restaurant, you can just cook at home. So where you've got something that's really a luxury and it is high risk, it completely is justifiable to implement something like a vaccine mandate and say you need to be vaccinated if you want to use my services. Where it's something more critical, like perhaps government services and things like that, then introducing that requirement of vaccination is a little bit harder to justify. So there's no one size fits all approach. You've really got to approach it on a spectrum. But overall, I think there's clear evidence in South Africa that supports that workplaces have a right to introduce these types of mandates, to fulfill their obligation to create a safe working space, and that all these individual rights in the exceptional circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic can undoubtedly be limited to protect the greater public health.
I like, you know, what you're talking about, because it reminds me of a principle in economics, public economics, where you talk about the free rider principle, to say that sometimes, like, you have a tax base, right, of let's say about a tenth of your population is paying for, you know, service delivery for the other 90%, you know, of your population. And that when you think about things like tax, you always have to think about them from the public good, right? How, what are we doing for the people as opposed to each individual person? And I'm really hearing that filtering into how you're saying what you're saying. And I guess just as a quick follow-up from my end is, vaccines and mandates are nothing new, because in certain cases, just to get to school, etc., you know, they're all of these things. So why has it been so hard from that point of view, right? Is it that there's no set legislation around vaccines specifically, or is it because, like you said, there's a spectrum we constantly always have to be looking at?
In South Africa, you are required to have a yellow fever vaccine if you are traveling to areas that have a higher risk of yellow fever. That has been in our legislation for almost two decades, and it was based on the international health regulations that were introduced by the World Health Organization that made it a requirement. Now, that's been in place. It's never been challenged. Nobody's thought it's controversial. I think there are two reasons for that. The one is, it's a very small group of people. It's people who are traveling to high-risk areas, generally East Africa. And that travel is not, like, it may be a necessity for your work, but you can opt out of it if you really oppose the vaccine. I think the second reason is that there is a totally radically different landscape now around anti-vaccine sentiments than there was a decade ago. This kind of anti-vaxxer conspiracy theory type of mindset was really in the fringes of society until very, very recently. This is not a common thing where people have felt like vaccines are really bad. Think about how, you know, we've had polio eradication because people have so well understood the need for polio vaccines. So really, I think there's a series of things that have happened that have made the environment now very ripe for fostering anti-vaccination sentiment. That said, as much as we see it in the mainstream, there is also a debate about whether we see the same levels of vaccine hesitancy and anti-vaxxer sentiment in the global south or in sub-Saharan Africa. There was a brilliant article, I think it was in the New England Journal of Medicine, where it said, we're not vaccine hesitant, we just don't have enough doses. And that's the ongoing debate at the moment is, are people really vaccine hesitant, or are they just struggling to get access to vaccines? So I think it's a multi-layered conversation. One last thing I'll say is that I think in particular, the COVID-19 vaccine is sort of a lightning rod for attracting these theories because it was developed so fast. And so even rational people who would normally be okay with vaccines are hesitant now because with polio or measles, okay, people have been taking it for decades. This vaccine is new and I don't know what it's going to do to me in the long term. So there's a couple different reasons why I think COVID-19 vaccines are particularly controversial, but I wouldn't say that there's any justification for that change, if I can put it that way.
Mm. And that, I think, helps us to, you know, move on to what I think is going to be quite an interesting one.
And Mudiwa, before you get to that interesting bit, which I can't wait to hear, can I just pick up on something Safura said, which is about, you know, the rapid development of the vaccines? Just to say, from a clinical perspective,
you know, the doctor in me. It's kind of almost miraculous. It's amazing that modern medicine has, in the matter of just over a year, managed to find and identify safe vaccines for this condition. The truth of it is, and in fact, I learned a lot of this from Safura's family, who are experts in the subject. The virus has this unique simplicity about it in that it has this typical spike protein, which we've all come to understand and recognize now, which actually makes vaccine development for this virus quite simple. That's part one. Part two is that the technology that's been used in the two different main vaccine types, the mRNA vaccine and the adenovirus vector vaccine. So mRNA is like Pfizer and Moderna. You know, that's been worked on for 10 years plus. It's not new technology. And they were able to very quickly just refocus their efforts on this quite simple viral protein to use the mRNA technology. The adenovirus vector vaccine, like Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca, that's been around for tens and tens of years. Many of the vaccines that are administered commonly use this technology. So the one important point to make to you is that while it is natural to have fear about a new medicine, and people say to me, it hasn't been trialed over tens of years and we don't have the long-term side effects, these are not new technologies. These are well-established technologies, and this is a relatively simple vaccine, which has allowed it to be developed very quickly. And typically, all these vaccines in these categories, the serious side effects are visible within, they say, 28 days, but certainly within usually 3 months. And so what we know about these vaccines, after we've given 6 billion doses now across the world, is that we understand the safety profile very well. And we can feel quite confident around this. And I think it's just an important point to make in the context of a mandatory vaccination discussion around the safety elements that Safura raised. If you want real information about this, you should ask her to get access to her family.
I like the fact that you do bring up this issue of safety, the rapid pace at which this has been developed, and the fact that, you know, this is technology that was previously used, which from a scientific point of view would aid in the confidence that are out there. So I think that then feeds into one of the big fears around people. And you mentioned it just now about side effects, right? To say, if someone does get side effects, I get my shot today, whether it's Pfizer, whether it's Johnson & Johnson, which is what we have here in South Africa at the moment, and I do exhibit some of the side effects, maybe they get really serious. The question from those that we're talking to might be, okay, so who's liable? Right, you know, for something like that. And this is something that I'm really keen to get both your thoughts on, starting with Ryan, since you're already on a roll.
Safura can give the legal perspective on this. The first point is that in the procurement agreements with the manufacturers, the country has agreed, like all countries that have been procuring, they've agreed a no-fault compensation fund. So in every dose of vaccine that's purchased, there is money that goes into a centrally managed fund to cover the cost of severe side effects. And so the first comment, Madiwa, to be understood is that this is a well-capitalized situation in respect of any liability that does arise. That's part one. And it's about a US dollar for every dose that goes into this no-faults liability fund. And it's well-governed, well-managed, centrally held. And for every dose we give around the country, the fund is capitalized. And so people can be rest assured that if they do have a severe side effect, there is the central financial support to assist. That's part one. Part two, for those people that have medical scheme cover, and typically our customers in this situation, COVID-19 as a disease and its vaccination is considered a prescribed minimum benefit. What that means in the medical schemes law, in terms of the Medical Schemes Act, medical schemes have to cover the cost of it and any complications from it in full from risk funds, with no out-of-pocket exposure to the customers. So for medical scheme members, our customer base, they have full cover from their medical schemes, And that is mandated by the law and overseen by the associated regulations. And so for medical scheme members, there's full cover. For non-medical scheme members, the state has accepted and acknowledged the liability that public health care will deliver care in full for free at public hospitals for any complications of vaccination. And then lastly, one may ask, what happens if I have a permanent disability or if I face death? What happens to my life insurance or my disability cover? That remains completely intact. And life insurers and disability insurers who have a policy wording, policy terms in place with you, cannot introduce an exclusion for, you know, complications of vaccination once that policy is in place. And so your cover remains completely intact in that regard for people that have that type of insurance. So I hope I've been very clear about this liability and reassuring. Remember that the vaccines do have side effects. Indeed, nobody is claiming they do not. The vast majority of those side effects are extremely mild. They last a day or two and they pass. In a few rare cases, there have been lasting side effects. But in our data, we've administered more than 2,000 doses of vaccines now to our members. We haven't got a single member who's living with a long-lasting severe side effect that hasn't been easily managed to date. And so that should really be reassuring.
All right. So that's, you know, the take on the discovery side, the legal side, Safura?
Well, I don't know if Ryan secretly studied law because he also captured the legal position pretty well. Just to echo his point, which is beyond Discovery's own data, SAHPRA has also indicated that there have been no deaths resulting from the administration of COVID-19 vaccines. He correctly described that there is this fund that was created. It was created before the first doses were administered under the Sonke trial. So it's been in place for quite some time now. And this is the same model that has been followed globally. It makes sense because, in a way, manufacturers are unwilling to sell their vaccines to countries if they're not exempted from liability. But, you know, because under our law, there needs to be some mechanism to make a claim if you do experience these very severe adverse effects. That's why we've created this fund. It not only creates exemptions for manufacturers, but also for healthcare workers who may have also been involved in some way, which I think is quite important because it enables healthcare workers to operate free from a shroud of doubt or be concerned about things because the virus is so novel. But overall, I'm not aware of a single claim that is being filed under this fund because it seems like people haven't experienced these types of side effects. The only thing I wanted to add to what Ryan said is this fund only covers vaccines that are administered in South Africa, and it only covers specific types of vaccines, generally those that have been approved by SAHPRA. So if you are getting your vaccine elsewhere, or you are getting a vaccine that it hasn't been SAHPRA approved, for example, like the Sputnik vaccine or some other type, then you will not be able to claim from this fund. And so I think as employers are listing what types of vaccines are considered sufficient under their own policies, or whether you as an individual are thinking about getting your vaccine somewhere else, that may just be something that you can bear in mind when you're making that decision.
Okay. No, and I think with everything that you're saying, I'm glad to see that someone like you is giving confidence, you know, that Ryan could moonlight, you know, as legal as a legal advisor out there.
That I'm a doctor and not a lawyer.
But coming back to the real, you know, sort of, you know, technical bits around the law, we understand that employers are obliged to notify employees who are identified for mandatory vaccinations in their risk assessments and vaccination rollout plans that they are entitled to refuse vaccination on medical or constitutional ground. You know, things such as the right to bodily integrity, encapsulated in section, you know, 12 of the Constitution, and the right to freedom of religion, belief, opinion in Section 13 of the Constitution. So what steps should an employer take in the event that an employee refuses to be vaccinated? I think earlier on, we did describe the spectrum that you were talking about. But this sort of comes back to the practicality, the pragmatic considerations that we had asked Ryan earlier on. But this is sort of more taking a step back to say, what are some of those steps that employers can or should be taking?
It's very important in any, whenever any employer wants to implement this type of policy, that they A, have an exemptions process. Because like I mentioned, there's this discrete group. They're not big, but the people who are refusing on the basis of health grounds need some mechanism to apply for an exemption. And then a company can decide how far they want to expand that, how big they want to make the hole in their Swiss cheese, so to say. Once that exemption process is in place, there needs to be some type of mechanism or system in place to evaluate that. And you need to ensure that whoever is evaluating it is equipped to do so, either through having their own type of expertise. So you may have like an occupational health and safety expert or medical expert who can sit and adjudicate that. Or you need to have very clear guidelines in your own policy that enable somebody from HR to make that decision. Once they've made that decision, generally, one would also include some type of appeals process. And that's just to make sure that if there was a mistake or maybe the person didn't provide 100% of the right information and they want to further substantiate the application, they can do so. I believe once an employer has followed those steps, they should be within their rights to take whatever action they deem necessary to ensure the healthfulness and safety of their environment. So provided they've given the employee some mechanism by which to apply for exemption, they've been quite transparent about how those exemptions are being given. And again, it's underpinned by that idea of mutual respect that Ryan was describing earlier. So provided those things are in place, really, there shouldn't be any difficulty with whatever measures the employer wants to make. I will say we are in uncharted territory. I'm not aware of a single labor law case that has arisen from this or given a decision about this. So we're kind of going as lawyers off of what we think is logical, what has been the case for other instances of occupational health and safety hazards, etc. So this is just sort of based on general principles, but with sort of the asterisk that this could change depending on, I guess, the decision from the Labor Appeal Court or the Constitutional Court, which would override sort of these individual considerations. So, yeah.
No, definitely. And we will be watching to see how all of this stuff, you know, develops over time. Like you said, it's constantly evolving. And up to this point, it's been peaceful in the labor courts. But, you know, one hopes that, you know, sort of stays that way. So now as we round up the discussion, I think I'm going to give Ryan the last word. I think talking to your other colleagues on this platform, it really does sound as if Discovery has a lot of data on hand just around the COVID-19 itself. And then, you know, as more and more people are being vaccinated, collecting more data and just seeing what the evidence is on the ground around the effectiveness of vaccines and all that. So maybe you could talk to us about that, right? The effectiveness of these vaccines when it comes to actually limiting or mitigating the spread of COVID-19, just a way, you know, to sort
yeah,
of
I mean, you know, this is a critical issue that you raise, Madiwa, because fundamentally we wouldn't be doing this if we didn't have hard evidence as a data-driven organization that it works and that it's important and that it's safe, which we discussed earlier. So I'm not going to preempt an upcoming announcement in the next couple of weeks that we'll be making around a big vaccine efficacy study that we've done with experts using our data. But I would like to describe to you, you know, some principles. We're extremely fortunate. We almost have a unique data set at Discovery in that we have this, firstly, longitudinal data through Vitality about the wellness of our customers, how physically active they are, what their body mass index is, what their level of well-being and wellness is. Secondly, we have this very well curated clinical data set about their underlying chronic illnesses, their acute illnesses, their health status. So we've got wellness and we've got health. And now thirdly, we've got their vaccination status linked to whether or not they've had COVID-19 and how they've responded once they've had it. Have they needed admission to hospital, to ICU, if they needed ventilation, or sadly, tragically, has it resulted in an unfortunate death? When you put all of this data together in a very well-structured data environment with excellent metadata, around it, we have really been able to have a unique insight into the safety and efficacy of COVID-19 vaccination and the impact and resilience of our customers relative to unvaccinated individuals and relative in some cases, to unhealthier people who are less physically active in our data. I tell you, we'll be releasing this formally, publicly in the next couple of weeks. It's taken a lot of work to finalize this, but it is compelling that the vaccine efficacy of both the Pfizer double shot vaccine and so far the single dose of J&J in our country is astoundingly excellent. And it reduces risk of death massively. It reduces risk of hospitalization materially. It also reduces risk of infection, less so after the Delta variant has come around, but notwithstanding which, it still does indeed reduce your risk of infection. That means, from a workplace perspective, the subject of today's conversation, that, you know, if we want to ensure that we don't put our employees at risk and we want to protect our employees in the workplace and when they leave our workplace, we are convinced from the data that vaccination is the right thing to do and a safe thing to do. And I really hope that this does serve as an exciting preview to our release of this formal vaccine efficacy data, which is going through a peer review process at the moment, is being carefully considered to make sure that the evidence that we're releasing is responsible. We're convinced that in a South African context, it's very powerful. It's not somebody else's data. It's people like us living in our country having received vaccines in our supply chain. And I think that'll be quite compelling.
We do certainly look forward to seeing that data as and when it does come out. We will be keeping an eye out for that. So that was us. We were talking to Dr. Ryan Noach, who is the CEO of Discovery Health, together with Safura Abdul Karim, who is a public health lawyer, just around mandatory vaccine policies in South Africa. Discovery became one of the biggest and first large corporates to actually mandate that they're going to be having mandatory vaccination policy effective from the 1st of January in 2022. And we just ran through their thinking around, you know, some of those issues. And then, you know, we had Safura giving us insights, you know, from a public health and legal point of view, just around, you know, whether or not employers can, you know, do this and some of the processes that can actually be put in place around all of those things. And then just talking about the efficacy of the different vaccines, and Ryan just ending off talking about the fact that they do have their own data. And the big thing that they are talking about is the fact that vaccines help to reduce, cases of serious infection and death, and that they're going to be publishing out some studies that is currently under peer review, and we will be looking out for that. So thank you so much to Ryan and to Safura for your time, and thank you for tuning into this Discovery's Everything You Need to Know About COVID-19 and Vaccines podcast, where we unpack the facts surrounding COVID-19 and vaccines in South Africa. If you haven't already, you can find our other episodes on iono.fm, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, wherever you choose to stream your podcasts. These episodes are published on the Business Day and Business Live website. Please subscribe for other episodes if you haven't already listened to others in this series, so you don't miss out. I've been your host, Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. Please stay safe, stay healthy, and make sure that you just go back and listen to some of those previous episodes. Everything You Need to Know About COVID-19 and the Vaccines podcast. This has been sponsored by Discovery Health.